young adult stories are about coming of age and discovering who you are and finding your place in the world. And when you're biracial, that adds another element that other people might not understand.
A new novel by Michigan's Angeline Bouley is not just one of the most anticipated YA reads of the year. It's also a complex story about a girl finding her way in two cultures. Did I mention it's also a ripping thriller that kept me up in a marathon late-night read? Move over, Nancy Drew. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Over the past few years, I would hear about Firekeeper's Daughter. The buzz in 2019 was that 12 different imprints were competing to publish it. And once Henry Holt emerged as the winner, the novel was optioned by none other than Higher Ground. You know, the little production company that Barack and Michelle Obama founded? It's going to be a series on Netflix. There's plenty to say about Angeline Bouley herself, too. She grew up around Sault Ste. Marie, where the book is based. She's an enrolled member of the Sioux Tribe of Chippewa Indians. And writing is not her first career. She's an educator and administrator. And for several years, she was the director of the Office of Indian Education at the U.S. Department of Education. We were very excited to get a chance to talk to her about the book. Before we get into it, though, one thing. While Firekeeper's Daughter is a young adult novel, it does involve some themes that won't be appropriate for all young readers. Angeline Bouley, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
You open the novel with an extremely dramatic scene and one that repeats throughout the book with little different bits of context. It's such an attention-grabbing read. Would you mind reading it out loud for us?
Oh, I would love to. I am a frozen statue of a girl in the woods. Only my eyes move, darting from the gun to their startled expression. Gun, shock. Gun, disbelief. Gun, fear. The thumb, the thumb, the thumb. The snub-nosed revolver shakes with tiny tremors from the jittery hand aiming at my face. I'm gonna die. My nose twitches at a greasy sweetness. Familiar. Vanilla and mineral oil. WD-40. Someone used it to clean the gun. More scents. Pine, damp moss, skunky sweat, and cat pee. The thumb, the thumb, the thumb. The jittery hand makes a hacking motion with the gun, as if wielding a machete instead. Each diagonal slice toward the ground gives me hope. Better a random target than me. But then terror grips my heart again. The gun, back at my face. Mom, she won't survive my death. One bullet will kill us both. A brave hand reaches for the gun, fingers outstretched, demanding. Give it now. The thumb, I am thinking of my mother when the blast changes everything.
Such an incredible scene. Were you always a fan of thrillers and mysteries?
Yes, I was. Both of my parents were just and still are tremendous readers. And so as a kid, we always had books. We always went to the library. And so I started out with the Nancy Drew. My brother read the Hardy Boys. I read the Hardy Boys. And just it kind of grew from there. I think in elementary school, liking Robert Cormier, I Am the Cheese, that kind of really threw me for a loop that a story could have such a twist at the end like that. And then I, of course, love Shirley Jackson and pretty much everything written by Lois Duncan. And so just that thriller that always has this twist and really what you think you're reading, and then at the end you realize that there was another story that was happening.
It's so elegant the way you bring us back to this scene again and again with a little bit more detail each time and build that reveal. Could you tell us a little bit about when and how you first started to build this story centered around one traumatic night in your head?
Well, actually, it started about 38 years ago, believe it or not. So when I was a senior in high school, a friend of mine went to a different school, and she told me about a guy in her senior class, a new guy, and she thought he would be my type. And I asked about him from time to time, but she let me know, oh, he, you know, doesn't play sports and hangs out with the stoners. And then at the end of the school year, she, you know, was all excited and told me there was a major drug bust at the school. And it turned out that that officer was an undercover narcotics officer. And it just made me think about, like, what if there were an undercover investigation in my school? And what if someone, you know, was, what if I was in classes with a person? And what if I liked them? And what if they liked me? And really the idea for the story was like, wait, why would some undercover investigation need an ordinary person's help? And so that's kind of where the story started all those years ago. And then throughout my career, I've always worked in tribal communities, and just seeing some of the issues that went on, and also that spawned into identity issues. Kids were still hearing the same things that I heard when I was growing up about, you know, oh, you don't look Indian, or, you know, not being Indian enough. And I really, my daughter was a preteen at the time, about 12 years ago, when I decided to write this Indigenous Nancy Drew story. And that's how it all started.
Let's talk a little bit about your heroine, Donis Fontaine. She's in the middle of trying to figure out exactly where she fits in. She's biracial. She's really smart and has an aptitude for chemistry, but she's also kind of a jock. She plays hockey. And she and her best friend, Lily, they're both Native, but they're not enrolled in the Sioux tribe. Why did you make that decision that was something you wanted to explore?
I thought that was really interesting to focus on, you know, have that be a major part of the story about identity, because young adult stories are about coming of age and discovering who you are and finding your place in the world or in your community. And when you're biracial, that adds another element that other people might not understand. And, you know, it gets into things like colorism and microaggressions and code switching and all of these things of how is my identity perceived by others? And at what point does it come from within me? And you learn to tune out or shut out those outside voices telling you what you are or are not.
As if all of that weren't enough, Donis, who's just 18 years old, life has run her through several hard things. Her uncle died, her grandmother has had this stroke, and her mom is just sleepwalking through the grief of these and other things in their lives. In your observation, that dealing with that level of hardship, could you tell us a little bit about what you see that doing to young women?
I think that Donis finds herself in this caretaker role of her mother has been the caretaker. And then Donis realizes her mother is running herself ragged, taking care of the grandmother, and has taken care of Donis and has gone through these traumatic things that Donis has also. But she sees that her mother has no one taking care of her. I wouldn't say it's a burden. Maybe Donis might see it as such in the beginning of there's no one to look after her but me. I have an obligation to make sure I can't just leave her like this. And plus she overhears her mother kind of confessing this, you know, deep-seated fear about losing Donis if she moves away, that she's not going to be able to endure the absence of Donis.
Yeah. The aspects of Anishinaabe culture and spirituality that are sort of the cross threads in this story. It's done in a way that invites people in who may not be familiar, but I imagine also provides a lot of stable context to people who are reading this, you know, maybe having grown up in the UP or maybe as part of the tribe. As you were writing, was there anything that was useful to keep in mind as you thought about how you were going to incorporate things in a way that was respectful, but that also, you know, also let the story serve as a window?
Well, I do believe that stories do provide that window, but it's important to have a curtain over that window too at times. And in particular, for Indigenous authors, I think it's really important if you're going to write anything about ceremony or things that perhaps aren't shared outside of your community, to really be mindful of your audience. And once you write those words, you give up ownership of that. And you just need to be very careful. So I had this mantra while I was writing the story that I write to preserve my culture and I edit to protect it. And so I don't include specifics about ceremony. I'll do the fade to black because that's not for people outside of those ceremonies to know.
At the same time, it's a really generous read in terms of not just describing things that would be important to Donis in her life, but helping us feel them. There's a point at which someone in the story dies and the action slows down as Donis is meditating and sort of having in her mind what's happening to the deceased, that the deceased is spending one day thinking about or confronting his or her loved ones and spending one day reckoning with everyone and everything she's ever done harm to in her life. It was such an interesting way of having the story keep pace with Donis's understanding and experience of what was happening.
Sure, because the third day of Injekid, which is in Ojibwe teachings, when someone passes, it's a four-day journey for them to go to the next world. And each of those days has a specific purpose. And so it really fit with the story that as this loved one is making that journey, the third day is for learning new ways. That is when Donis is introduced to some new things, and her, at first she's reluctant, but really realizing, wait, this is the day to learn new things. And I thought that that would be a good way to show how our knowledge about our culture, it informs how we live our lives and decisions that we make.
We need to take a short break. Coming up, more of our conversation with author Angeline Booley. Stick around.
Support for Michigan Public's Stateside podcast comes from Lake Trust Credit Union, working to empower financial well-being for Michigan consumers, businesses, and communities. Committed to financial solutions and advice to support people and families. More information at laketrust.org.
Support for the Stateside podcast comes from Kalamazoo College, offering a personalized education that combines critical thinking, curiosity, and creativity. Committed to preparing students for meaningful careers that make a positive impact on the world. More at kzoo.edu.
Another thing that I just loved so much about the book is I was just 100% there for the elders' jokes. All the elders' jokes. Lines like, I don't have enough years left to tell you what's wrong with this pasty. Or, have you seen her drive? She never even lets that Mustang gallop. I mean, it was...
Yeah, and the elders who pat the hood of their car and say, good pony.
Good pony, just... yeah, right.
Yeah.
They were such a delight. I could really see them.
Yeah. Oh, well, I love my elders. And I was so fortunate. I worked for my tribe for maybe a dozen years, and part of that time, I oversaw our elder division and cultural and education divisions, and so I did spend a lot of time with our elders too, and would have lunch with them, and just the things that they say that just would crack me up, and then I've got a lot of relatives there, and then my dad's always saying stuff too. So I just love elder humor.
You managed to do so many different kinds of lifts in this book. It's a real ripping thriller, but at the same time, there's so much here as a coming of age story for this young woman, and sort of just figuring out her place in her tribe and where she's meant to move into the world, and all her interpersonal relationships with her families, and the importance of girl friendship. You've worn so many professional hats. Which of them do you think was most important to pulling this book together?
I think that my work with tribal teens has been the most important because working with students in school or after school programs or summer youth programs, just spending time with teens and hearing them when they let down their guard and they talk freely around you. And that they experience similar things that, and then there are other ways that they're experiencing things that I could never have fathomed when I was growing up. And so I think that, for example, methamphetamines and social media, the hold that social media has with people in general, not just young people, those are the things that have helped me to write a story that is relatable.
Firekeeper's Daughter got a lot of attention early on, and that's awesome. But we do know that there are any number of Native writers who have trouble breaking through in publishing. They may have to rely on gatekeepers, big names in literature, to give them an endorsement or a reference, or maybe an endorsement from one of the big Native writers who publishers know. Was that at all an issue in the early stages of trying to get this book out into the world?
There was a sense of that early on, just because I think 10 years ago, 12 years ago now, when I first started writing the story, there were those one or two big names, and then you didn't really hear a whole lot else. So it was, wait, how can I break into this? But really, I just focused on writing the best story that I could, always improving my writing craft to do justice to the story that I knew I wanted to tell. And then I was just so incredibly fortunate that I went to my first ever writer's retreat, and it was specifically for Native children's literature aspiring writers. And so these were fellow Indigenous people that wanted to write either picture books or chapter books, middle grade, young adult. And what I found out is that I can't speak to adult literary circles or gatekeepers, but I do know that my experience with the Native kid lit community or children's literature community, that per se, is so incredibly supportive. And people that I met at that retreat have been dear friends and now, fellow authors, and really helped to open some doors in the publishing world.
As Dawnis is trying to unravel this mystery that is doing so much damage in her community, she makes a lot of choices that stem from her need for justice. But at a certain point in the book, she comes to see that need in a different definition than the justice that traditional law enforcement, tribal or otherwise, can offer. And she makes this comment that the community needs to be part of any solution. What was that about for you? At what point did you come to a realization that you needed that to be part of the story?
I have spent my career working in different tribal communities, and then at the national level, at the federal level. And when communities identify issues and come up with the programs or services to address those needs, they are more successful than solutions imposed upon a community by, you know, either well-intentioned or whatever entities outside of that community. That's just how it is. Solutions are always better coming from within.
As you think back to that yourself as a young reader, the Nancy Drew reading kid who was getting drawn into narrative, is there anything that you wanted to make sure was in this book that might reach out to young readers, I guess non-Native too, but maybe especially to young Native readers, and what you wanted this book to make available to them?
I really wanted young, teen readers to, especially those who are biracial, to see themselves in a story. It wasn't until I was a senior in high school that I read a book where the protagonist was Native and, you know, had a Native father and a non-Native mother. And I was just stunned. Once I saw it, I realized, wait, I haven't seen this before. And why is that? That's why identity is such a powerful theme in stories, because for all of the readers, all the teens out there who have felt maybe that living in both worlds or not enough or, whatever struggles they go with, to feel seen in a story, I think that can do wonders for your self-identity and seeing yourself in the world, your place in it. I think that books and stories can do so much to help young people.
Angeline Bulley's debut novel is Firekeeper's Daughter. It's going to publish mid-March, and you can get in an early request for it with your favorite bookseller right now. Angeline, the book is so amazing. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, miigwech. Thank you.
And that's the Stateside Podcast. I'm April Baer. You can find more of Stateside streaming at michiganradio.org. If you like what you're hearing, please do rate the show and leave a review for us. It helps other people find what we're doing. The executive producer of Stateside is Laura Weber Davis. Today's episode was produced by Rachel Ishikawa. Our theme music is by 14KT, additional music by Blue Dot Sessions. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week.